Right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My apologies for being slightly late arriving myself. My name is Heather Loveday, and I am pleased to be chairing the E.M. Cottrell Lecture for this year, previously being presented by Robert Pratt, Professor Jackie Riley, Anne Bialikowski, and last year Professor Judith Tanner. This year we're really pleased to welcome Martin Kiernan, a previous president of IPS, and to present what I'm sure is his own personal reflections on the life and times of the urinary catheter. Martin.
Thank you very much, Heather. It's nice to be amongst friends back in the IPS. I'm absolutely honoured to be asked to present the Cottrell Lecture. Which is, of course, a precursor to the main event of the meeting, which is the IPS AGM, that I know you'll all be eagerly looking forward to. Any of you who follow Twitter, I've preloaded Twitter with some tweets that will appear during this session, which will be links to any references that I'm going to refer to during the talk. So, you know, if you're following that on Twitter, you'll be able to just link through to what I'm talking about. So why on earth am I talking about a urinary catheter now? It's not very sexy, is it? It's not central line. Is it culture related? Because we've been hearing lots about culture this morning. I'm really quite passionate about these devices because there's nothing really new about them, but actually there's nothing really new about them. I need to make the usual disclosures. I've been members of various advisory boards and presented at educational meetings, but the views that I'm going to give you this morning, of course, are my own. So what's in the name? Well, the catheter is, of course, Greek to let down, and it's been around for a couple of thousand years now. Okay. People have stuck all sorts of things up their urethras to relieve retention of urine, including straw, rolled up palm and garlic leaves. Then they moved on to metals. Actually, it's not the only unusual things people have stuck up their urethras or have appeared in urethras. I don't know if you remember the Horizon programme a few years ago on parasites. And there was in the Amazon, evidently, there's a small fish that if you have a pee while you're standing in the Amazon, the fish detects urea and swims up the urethra, attaches itself to the inside of the urethra and then sucks the blood out. What I want to know is how the first fish decided that was a good place to go. It's a bit of an odd one. Anyway, after the various different natural materials were moved on to metals, gold, silver, brass, lead, and silver was then used because it's malleable and you could actually bend it to the shape of the male urethra. It was a common thing for elderly gentlemen to walk around with a urinary catheter, their own catheter stuck in their hat band. Benjamin Franklin is credited with inventing the silver urinary catheter, but he actually is credited to somebody in Italy before that. And as it turns out, silver's antiseptic anyway. Then rubber came along, but of course, until vulcanisation happened, catheters were quite crumbly at body temperatures, leaving little bits left behind. So that wasn't particularly effective. What happened then? Well, how did we fix them to people? The early ones had shoulders. You could tie them to the penis, and they were stitched to the female urethra, which can't be very comfortable. By now, I should have everybody's attention. You should be squirming for the next 25 minutes, so you're not going to nod off. And then the last major innovation, really, came in the 30s in design terms. Some of the materials has changed, but the balloon was introduced by Foley, who was an American medical student, went on to become a urologist, who, interestingly, didn't patent the design. Bard patented it. But we still call them the Foley catheter. But that was the last really big innovation in design of a catheter. So we're almost coming up to the 100th anniversary of the present design for something that's been around for thousands of years. Now, we use a lot of these things. Okay. Now, we have some measure of how much we use of these in hospitals in the UK. The National Prevalence Study, organised by the ICNHIS back in 2006, quoted 32% of patients with a catheter at that time, with another 6% in the previous 7 days. And fast forward that on a few years to 2011, that's fallen to 18%. That shows you that we've done a pretty good job at reducing catheters, but I'm not sure we're at the bottom yet. But they have come down. This study, also coordinated by Susan Hopkins at Public Health England, showed that 43% of healthcare-associated urinary tract infections were linked with urinary catheters. Actually, when I look at that, I could almost reverse that and say there's an awful lot of healthcare-associated urinary tract infections that aren't linked with urinary catheters. So we have some idea of use in hospitals, but how many outside hospitals? I've never seen any data on any sort of prevalence study, apart from small snapshots done in care homes, as to how many catheters there are out there in the community. And now I've got the latest version of ICNet, and I'm seeing every single result that comes through. I'm seeing staggering numbers of urinary specimens coming from catheterised patients, and I'm sure not every catheterised patient is sampled all the time. So I think we have to also reflect on the fact that catheters are not just a hospital problem, they are a community problem. So they're not a benign intervention either. I mean, people tend to think of infection as the most common healthcare-associated infection, and that's the most common risk. But talk to the users, and I'm going to come back to that with a study later on. There's pain, there's all the blockages. How many people end up having to have district nurses visit them regularly to have their catheter unblocked? Now, Proteus is well known to cause blockages in catheters, and you know every 10 days Mr. Jones is going to block his catheter, so you visit him on the eighth day to see if you can circumvent that, and so that he doesn't end up in A&E having it changed. But how much of this is a burden? What about bypassing? What about stones occurring and long-term use in spinal injuries? Tumours are a risk. And we really have no idea of the burden of these other unfortunate side effects of having a urinary catheter, especially a long-term one, apart from the infections that figure always very highly in national prevalence studies. Now, one thing I just want to mention very briefly is that you may have noticed MRSA bacteremia has dropped, and Hugo mentioned it quite staggeringly, and I'm grateful to Susan Hopkins again for this slide. And all Staph aureus bacteremia is down, but look at E. coli rocketing away. Look at Klebsiella going up as well. Now, the numbers aren't big for Klebsiella, but they've doubled in those years, and it's carried on going up. And we actually don't know why this is. We've taken part in national surveillance in England. Is it catheters? Is it people who are having gallbladder problems? Is it people who have got uropathogenic strains? Is it food? Antibiotic resistance? The elderly? We really don't know. Well, what about global warming? We can blame virtually everything on global warming. Well, I hear you snigger, but actually, here's a really nice study from Jenny Wilson, which I think slipped a bit under the radar, that showed that actually it's seasonal trends in E. coli bacteremia and all gram negatives. So in the summer it goes up, and in the winter it goes down. So what's causing that? Now, I'm tempted to suggest dehydration in the elderly is a big issue here, but I've noticed in some papers from the States that they are saying that maybe barbecues and increased sexual activity during the summer are the reason for it. Well, given that 3/4 of our cases happen in the over 70 years, I'm looking forward to long and happy retirement, but I suspect that may not be the case. So I just think there's more things going on out here, and a lot of people say, well, all these E. coli bacteriums are coming into the community, nothing we can do about it, why are we doing the surveillance? I think we may not have the action, but somebody will have, and I think hydration in the elderly is becoming more and more of an issue, and the more people I talk, the more thing it fits with. So that's just a little aside. So what we're dealing with now is the original medical device, the urinary catheter, okay, used for maybe a couple of thousand years, millions of people worldwide every day. Most healthcare professionals will put at least one in at some time in their career, and many will do it repeatedly. So therefore, we must have the most fantastic evidence base, mustn't we? Well, I'm going to share with you the evidence base for long-term catheters. And if you look on the bottom left-hand corner of that shelf, you'll see that's it. We've got a fair amount, we've got some for short-term catheters, but where's all the evidence for long-term catheters? They go out into the community. Oh, retention, come in. Right, okay, we'll sort that out, and maybe it'll take 6 months to get your surgery sorted out. Long-term catheter in for that time. Other people have them left in for a long time. When you talk to patients, they actually don't know sometimes why they had the catheter put in, and neither does anybody looking after them, because it's lost back in the notes at some stage. Can we reduce catheter use? Well, there's plenty of evidence out there to say, yes, you can reduce catheter use, generally by doing things like taking them out quickly. Here's a systematic review from Meddings and Company showing that stop orders were effective, catheter-associated infections down 52%, duration of catheter down 52%. A lot of the papers are from the States, and in the States you have four steps to removing a catheter. Firstly, the physician says there is one. Secondly, he says there's no longer a need. Thirdly, he writes a take-it-out order. Fourthly, the nurse takes it out. What happens in the UK? Do the physicians always know there's a catheter? If you talk to them doing a root cause analysis, say this bacterium is caused by the catheter, they say, what catheter? I suggest you want to take a walk around the bed sometime and see if there's anything hanging over the edge, and then ask why that's there. Now, we have actually had some very good work done in this country, and Deb Adams has published on this, on the Houdini study, and later taken up wider by the IPS R&D group, which is a nurse-led protocol for removing catheters. And in fact, there's another publication I haven't included in this by Faki, this year that talks about that nurses are the key instigators of catheter removal. And we did this in our organisation. The ward that did it reduced their catheters. The ward that didn't do it, number of catheters went up. It does seem to work. And in a Deb study, catheter usage down 17%, catheter specimens of urine down as well. They didn't quote Corti as such, but it's catheter specimens of urine with E. coli. In the interest of fairness, I should also say that other urinary pathogens are also available. So do reminders and stop orders work? Well, they can be useful, but they need, firstly, education. And I take Michael's point that you educate, then you educate again, then you make it mandatory, but which to me sounds a bit like people from the UK going abroad and speaking English very loudly at other people with the hope that they'll get the message. We have to find other ways of doing it. But we have to make sure people know that they're accountable for removing catheters. We have to make sure that we actually appropriately delegate responsibility for the management of the patient, and we must take action. Okay? When I have a look at patients sometimes, what I see repeatedly in the care plans when you're asking for a catheter review is catheter patent and draining. Well, I know that because there's something in the bag. But why does the patient have to have it? And you know, I've seen patients who've had catheters put in 4 months before for hourly urinary monitoring, which was never actually done, never reviewed. I've met patients in the hospital restaurant who have said to me, when can I have this catheter out? Because they're just out wandering around, they're bored. Go back to the ward. When can the catheter come out? When he's stable. He's eating fish and chips in the hospital canteen. He's fairly stable. I think it can probably come out now. So let's get the reviewing going better. Now, I'm going to highlight a couple of studies about reducing prevalence. I've got a couple of reasons for mentioning this one, but from Rothfield and Stickley, but they implemented their program for reducing catheters to just specific indications, you know, like obstruction and output monitoring and pressure ulcers, etc. The driver for this actually was the reimbursement criteria change in the States, where you don't get paid for a hospital-acquired catheter-associated infection anymore. So they implemented these orders, and that you can only put one in for these reasons, and the number of infections went down. Also, the number of catheters went down. So they reduced the number of catheter days from 42% from 300 per 1,000 patient days down to 190. The number of catheter-associated urinary tract infections also went down. A smaller number, but they did go down. And there was a significant reduction in their rate per 1,000 patient days, a statistically significant reduction. Now, that is the rate per 1,000 patient days, and there's a little bit of a word of caution on that one. What I wanted to highlight on this study, though, was, and I'm pleased they did it, because they actually interviewed people and said, how did it actually make you work, and why did you feel about it? And if you look at the top, they asked the nurses, okay, how would you rate the effect of the No Foley program in terms of the difficulty of your job, and most actually said it made it worse or you know, little effect. Only 25% said it made it actually easier to do, but 52% said they got more job satisfaction out of it. So people are very happy to work harder if they think that actually it's beneficial. I think that's really good. The patients, you know, didn't really affect them too much, although a lot seemed to think it was better. And as you notice on the bottom line, the physicians didn't notice anything was going on at all. So I think that people will work better, and as long as they know that there's something in it for them in terms of their job satisfaction. People like to feel they're making a difference, I think. Now, the next study I wanted to mention was about denominator, because you mentioned, I said on the last one, that the catheter-associated infection rate was reduced per 1,000 patient days. And you have to be a little bit careful with denominators. Now, here's a study that was also published in ICHI a couple of years ago. Utilisation down from 36 to 28%. I have to say, it's not an enormous reduction, that, and I think that's still quite a high prevalence at 28%, but... and it was across all units. It's quite a big organisation as well. The number of infections went down. The infection rates fell by 18% from 28.2 per 1,000 patient days down to 23.2. That's fine. But unfortunately, their actual measure was a reduction in the rate per 1,000 device days. And because you reduced the number of device days, the actual infection rate rose. Although it was not statistically significant, if you're standing in front of your chief exec saying, yeah, we've had this program, put this program in, but our infection rate's gone up from 7.8 to 8.3, he's not going to be too chuffed. So you have to be a little bit careful about how you choose your outcome if you actually want to measure the effect. I think that's really quite an important point. So the other problem I have sometimes is the detection of the infection actually robust? And do we know that what we're defining as an infection is true? Well, if you look at the published studies, you often get bacteriuria mentioned there or urinary tract infection. Sometimes they don't even tell you what definition they're used. And do the signs and symptoms of urinary tract infection work for catheters? Well, here's some work done by Dennis Mackey back in 2000 showed that, of course, people don't get a lot of the symptoms. 90% of people with a microbiological catheter-associated urinary tract infection did not have these symptoms. You don't get dysuria. You don't get urgency if you have a catheter in. Many elderly people don't get a fever. So it's very difficult. And actually, they found that only about half were actually going to be detected by using the laboratory. There was clinical choice used here. And this is the problem sometimes we have between clinical assessment of whether there's an infection or not and surveillance definitions. And as we all know, our clinical decision-making is patient-specific. You're standing in front of this person and you're going to make a treatment decision. Whereas you and I go around for surveillance purposes, it's a population-based decision and which we've got to apply uniformly and consistently. Now, there's a nice paper in press at the moment in the American Journal of Infection Control. It's by Fackey's group. And it's clinical diagnosis versus definitions. So they looked at adult inpatients with a positive urine culture in one centre. Nearly 400 urine specimens were looked at. And they found that they were all positive cultures, as I mentioned. The clinician initiated antibiotics in about 56% of cases. And they worked on organism and age. So if a certain organism or if the patient was old, that's why they got the antibiotics. Now, if you use the NHSN, which is the US definition, then actually only 1 in 3 fitted that definition, and that was dependent on size of fever, which is in the definition. Actually, if you got the ID physicians to go around, it's slightly less than that, and they were basing their definition of infection or their assessment of the patient's infection as on signs of sepsis, and they weren't necessarily the same people that were picked up in the other two groups. So if you actually use a gold standard as an infectious diseases physician opinion as to whether somebody has a catheter-associated urinary tract infection, then the NHS definition has a positive predictive value of 35%. And this is why it makes it very difficult to compare organisations if you're looking at infection rates. I have great sympathy and great respect for things like the Safety Express and latterly the Safety Thermometer, which look to collect some data, and they get people thinking about catheter-associated urinary tract infections, but you cannot use these data to actually compare organisations. I'm afraid it just doesn't work if you're going to use a treatment with antibiotics as your criteria. Because as we've been hearing this morning, culture makes such an enormous difference. And there are cultural differences in medical teams as well. If you go on ward rounds, there are some medical groups who will treat infections that you think is not an infection and others that won't treat one that you do. So I have just a big health warning on using data published in the literature to work where you are locally. So, there are studies that show taking them out is effective, but actually what about putting them in? Now, the Ruffell and Stickley paper talked about specific indicators. HICPAC came out with their guidance a couple of years ago and listed their acceptable use. Now, notably, and of course, on that list is not incontinence. Incontinence is never a reason for passing a urinary catheter. And I'm sure you're all familiar with these. They're all quite acceptable reasons for passing a catheter. Sometimes, though, I want to drill into these reasons and actually find that what the reasoning was behind that device going in. So why are they inserted then? Well, if you look at medical records, they're not very helpful. You might do a case note review and decide, well, a lot of these catheters weren't required, but you've only got what was written down in the notes. And as this study here shows, the reason for insertion was actually documented in just 13% of notes. So often we don't know why the patient has the catheter. I see people coming from the community with the catheter. Why have they got the catheter? Or they came out of hospital with it last time. Why do they have the catheter in the community? And you go back and back and back, and they're revolving through the place. And actually the original reason for the catheter is long gone in history, if you ever knew it in the first place. Now, the problem I have with these quantitative studies is they don't tell you anything about decision-making, they don't tell you about who the staff groups are actually making the decision to catheterise, and they only include what the authors themselves consider to be appropriate, which they don't often define. So I've got a big health warning on those as well. Now, there's a nice paper by Cowie who looked at the clinical realities of catheterisation. Mixed methods study, they found that nurses were the key decision makers for catheterisation. I don't think you find that in many other countries. Often it's the clinician who's going to make the decision to catheterise. Their primary focus was the most prominent medical issue. So whatever the patient, it was most important for the patient, that's why the catheter went in. For the medical staff, it was retention or output monitoring. For the nurses, it tended to be skin care or comfort of the patient. There seemed to be unwritten rules based on gender, so only males could catheterise males, whereas females could catheterise females, and males couldn't. And it was all a bit mixed in the organisation. There was no involvement from patients and families, or virtually no involvement. But the issue I had with this study was they didn't really drill down into the decision-making because it didn't relate to a specific event. You know, what did you do for that catheter? Now, I did a small study that I presented here as a poster last year, and I just want to draw a couple of points out of this because I've got the podium, basically. But just a very small study, and 20 interviews, two predominant reasons for catheter insertion, mainly retention, then output monitoring, and there were some other reasons which were quite smaller. Nothing used for incontinence, which was very heartening for me. But who makes the decision? Often the nurses would say the medical staff made the decision. But when you probed the nurse, they said, well, I gave him, you know, they virtually gave him no choice by presenting a scenario that the medical staff just agreed with it. I also found that nurses were very frequent instigators of catheter use for retention in non-emergency settings out in the wards. And that was also quite interesting. I found the nurses were primarily motivated by getting rid of the symptom for the patient, which may have been distress or breathlessness or pain. I had to help him. Often the cause of the retention was never considered. Post-op retention never used an intermittent catheter. Surgical nurses actually couldn't provide me with a rationale for post-operative urinary retention in the post-surgical patient. I found patients who were fecally impacted, and an enema the next day meant the catheter could come out. And I couldn't remember, or none of the nurses I spoke to could recall any education at all on the causes of retention. So maybe we're missing a trick here. When I was looking at urinary output, There was no consideration of other methods of urine output measurement. You know, you've got somebody who's up walking around and they're having urine measurement done. Well, actually, you could use something technical called a jug to do that. And actually, or you could weigh a pad. There are other methods of doing it. And I think sometimes people just jump to, I've got to sort this problem out now, this is what I'm going to do. There were some external influences on catheterisation as well, particularly around trauma patients with fractured necks of femur. There were unwritten rules. It was expected of us to catheterise every female fractured neck of femur, which I don't agree with. This is a casualty nurse. Now, if you took the patient to the ward and they weren't catheterised, you got friction. So there was peer pressure also on it. Now, Michael this morning said culture is eaten for breakfast by strategy, and that's absolutely true. Sorry, other way around, isn't it? Yeah, anyway. Other findings. Patients were never really involved in it. You know, they were presented with, we need to do this, and yes, you know best. So the nurses were really pushing the catheter at them, I felt, almost. They were almost never asked for consent, and this was also found in the Cowie study. No formal consent whatsoever. Interesting. Active avoidance of the issue of discussion of the risks of catheterisation also. And virtually the only complication they mentioned to the patient was infection. Now, that may have been because they knew what I do for a living. But they never talked about pain, blockage, et cetera, as being a potential issue. And I suspect that's because they were acute hospital nurses and not seeing those effects in the long-term catheters. So I think there's opportunities for education there. It's interesting, though, this idea of risk perception, isn't it? Because I think the nurses I spoke to thought, well, because we're washing our hands and doing an aseptic technique, we've covered the infection side of things. And yet infection in the immediate post-catheterisation period is nothing compared with the duration of catheterisation. And I think, again, there's something here we can work on with people to actually make them understand that actually this is a device that increases the risk with the time that it's there. Harrod's done some work published on BMC Health Services Research this year, multi-sensor qualitative piece of work looking at perceptions of risk used to determine whether somebody needs a catheter or not. And he found that the issues were competing priorities with all the other patient safety initiatives we have thrown at us. There was also this lack of linkage with negative outcomes because the people putting the catheter in don't tend to see the unfortunate effect of them, especially for the long-term catheters. And what he also found was staff would actually, if you put an initiative in place, they would use a workaround. So if you gave a list of indications for catheterisation, which included other got used a lot. And nurses are very good at finding the way around something. And you know, this risk perception, I think I go back further than that, and I haven't got time to discuss this in great detail, but I really like this paper by Mary Dixon Woods looking at suboptimal infection control behaviours, ethnographic study. And again, it's back to the behaviour is not tightly coupled to the outcome. The infection cannot be traced back to the person who was involved in maybe leading to the infection. Blame is diffused throughout a group of people. and people then will question the evidence, and that isn't a substantial reason for healthcare-associated infection. Such that poor behaviour then becomes normal, therefore poor practice is non-deviant and remains unaffected. What about the risk in long-term catheters? This is a very nice study, just published in the Journal of Clinical Nursing. I corresponded with the author, Mary Wilde. There's more work coming in the not-too-distant future, but she did a nice set of interviews with 202 patients with long-term catheters in the community. Interesting the split here, because almost 50-50, urethral and suprapubic, and we don't use as many suprapubic catheters in the community here as we do elsewhere in the world, but patients are reporting linkage nearly half, urinary tract infection, blockages, pain, dislodgement, and yet we have no data on that in this country, and I don't think we even consider these things. But interestingly, subsurgical risk disclosure for informed consent is about a 1% risk or something. And if you're passing a catheter on and say you've got nearly a 50% risk of leakage, urinary tract infection 1 in 3, and that this doesn't include bacteremia, blockage 1 in 4, people might start saying, actually, do I really want this device? Do I really need it? And I don't think we do that enough. How do we move forward with this? Well, nothing much has changed with catheter design and nothing changed with collection system for an awfully long time. There must be some innovations out there that we can work with. There has to be something. We need so much more evidence. Long-term catheters, anything please on that. You know, looking at the suprapubic versus the urethral, looking at decision-making, looking at patient consent. What about community management? We send all these specimens. I'm seeing patients who, week after week, a CSU turns up in the lab and the result goes back. What happens? Who's sending it? Why are they sending it? Is the patient getting unnecessary antibiotics? And what difference would they make anyway? There's just so much work out there to be done on long-term catheters. And prophylaxis. I thought, hooray, in the last couple of weeks, I've seen a new paper. It's a review by Marshall. It's a systematic review, meta-analysis, prophylaxis for catheter removal suggests benefit. And the number needed to treat was 1 in 17, but this is for short-term catheters only. Again, what about the long-term catheter changes in the community? Plenty of people might think, well, we maybe need to cover them with antibiotics. We haven't got a substantial evidence base for that. Just to finish, last couple of slides. After 2,000 years, I think we should be doing a little bit better with our catheters. Use can be reduced. Don't put them in. Get them out very quickly. They should be, to me, a device of last resort and not of first response, and I'm afraid that's the way things are. I think we can do much more work on decision-making and making it easy to do the right thing. And I think we need to do much more qualitative work, because this is how we find out why people do things. Not that they do them, but why they do them. And not even just because culture can be not only specific to a hospital or a ward, it can be specific to a shift. We all know ward managers who run a ship very tightly, and when they're not on, the culture isn't anything like the same. Catheters have been with us 2,000 years. They're our most commonly used medical device. We must be able to do a bit better. To celebrate their 2000th anniversary, when people have been around that long, there's normally great works of literature, so I wrote a little poem about them. I am a urinary catheter, dark places I must go. My job is clear, I have no fear, I need to ease the flow. You are the one I am inside, it enters not your head, that if I'm let in, a mortal sin, you could just end up dead. At times, I am a useful aid, but my use you should not flout. On every day, someone should say, it's time to take me out. Thank you.